go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! About 2 minutes past the hour, this is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, my first day back after a little bit of time on the road. We'll talk about that in a little bit later. I had an amazing trip up to the shores of Lake Superior and the good people of Ashland and Iron Counties and of course my dear friends out on the Bad River Reservation, struggling against rogue hillbilly and serial poisoner Chris Klein, as he attempts to destroy that beautiful part of the country with his relentless greed and remorseless determination to see a beautiful community, you know, turned into a poisoned and dying place. We'll talk about all of that later, but I want to jump right into the heart of things this evening, because I have a dear friend who is on hold right now. My first conversation with Jeff Biggers took place almost as long ago now as the Horn is old. And we have had many conversations in the interim. Jeff Biggers, of course, is a tireless advocate and journalist, writing about struggles in communities threatened by extractive industries, by coal, by fracking. And he has an article out, a brand new article just today over at Huffington Post, Fracking Illinois, Two or Three Things We Know for Sure. And the minute I read it, I knew that we were going to be talking about this story, but I wanted to reach out to Jeff because he is going to be far better at talking about this issue than am I by myself. So without further ado, let's bring Jeff Biggers on. Hey, Jeff, do I still have you?
Yeah, going down the road. Good to talk to you, Bob.
Oh, it's always good to talk to you, Jeff. You've been doing magnificent work, and I guess it's work sort of close to home, because this particular article deals with fracking in Illinois, and I was wondering if maybe you could just give us a little bit of background on how we got to the point where you wound up writing this article.
Well, you know, as I think a lot of your listeners know, Illinois is really one of the oldest coal markets we have in the country. In fact, the first coal market, dating all the way back to the French who discovered coal in the 17th century. But to make a long story short, we've been fighting and dealing with the coal industry for years, and then suddenly, with hydraulic fracking, horizontal, is that they realized, oh my God, there's this incredible amount of oil and natural gas. And so not only did we have a revival of the coal rush that we've been dealing with for the past couple years, but now suddenly all the frackers were coming to the state. What made it extremely interesting, I think, to your listeners, Bob, is that Illinois is a very liberal, democratic state. Liberal Governor Quinn, Democrats control the legislature. And yet, even in a state like that, they had to sort of bow to the whims of the great coal and natural gas lobby. And they ran through a bill last year that really brought a lot of attention to the state, not simply for fracking, but how the environmental groups handled it. There was a very unfortunate split between the main big greens, as we refer to them, the main national organizations that are based in Chicago, primarily in Springfield, who wanted to once again make a compromise, versus the grassroots, the local citizens groups and environmentalists on the front lines, who said, hey, we can't do these compromises. We've dealt with over a century of coal mining mayhem. We don't want to have another century of mayhem with natural gas. And that's pretty much when I came into the story, was to chronicle and serve as a reporter for the voices that are fighting back.
And you have always been a voice for people left largely voiceless. You're absolutely right, Jeff. You chronicle some of the predatory practices in Appalachia in the United States, your book, award-winning book, The United States of Appalachia, and then you took it all the way right to home in Reckoning with Eagle Creek. And I'm guessing that did it come as a surprise to people who consider themselves either liberal or Democrat or progressive, or that they could be so rapidly sold out in the fracking fight?
You know, I think it was a real wake up call for a lot of young environmental activists and people who don't have the sort of background that we already have in coal mining. I think my role as a cultural historian was to remind people that, hey, you know, in the 1970s, we had a very vibrant and incredible, very inspiring movement to abolish shrimp mining. And that ultimately, when a liberal Democrat got into the White House, we had another compromise for various reasons. And a young congressman by the name of Nikki Jo Rahal was able to sort of pull the wool over old Mo Udall's eyes in Congress. And we created the Surface Mine Reclamation Act, which ultimately, as you know very well, federally sanctioned mountaintop removal. And that sort of compromise, led by, instigated, and ultimately manipulated by backroom deals with the big environmental lobbyists, always have undercut the interests of people who are paying the price. That's the people who live in the extraction areas. And so it was that sort of history that I had to bring back in Illinois, because we went through the same disaster at SMACRA. Of course, my family's 200-year-old farm was strip mined under SMACRA. And I think we tried to bring history into the debate of fracking, saying, hey, let's stop it before it starts, and please learn our history before you once again compromise so quickly, because we know what's going to happen. And today, frankly, was an article I wrote that the point of it was to say, look, we told you so.
And there's a lot of I told you so in it, just as there's a lot of we told you so in SMACRA. Of course, SMACRA predates any involvement I had. But you're absolutely right. You had people out there ostensibly acting on behalf of the environment, and the people living on the ground got hung out to dry, whether it be SMACRA and surface mining, or whether it be what happened to you in the last year in Illinois. What exactly was the process whereby the Illinois fracking sellout took place?
Well, for a little while, in the 2 years ago, there was a discussion to have a moratorium. And the idea was along the lines of what you're trying to do with the ACAC, which is to me one of the biggest no-brainers that we can imagine, is before you rush into this extraction mayhem, which will have extraordinary human and health and environmental costs, at least do your homework and know the science and know the health studies behind it and know ultimately what the cost is going to be. And I think that's why the ACAC, for example, mountaintop removal, should be pushed through immediately and passed. It does something that should have happened 40 years ago. Well, in Illinois, that was the whole push behind the moratorium, was to say, before you rush into this fracking, we don't know really what's going on in other states. We don't really have the scientific information of what's going on in Pennsylvania, where people's water is contaminated, where their water is taking fire, where we have horrific air pollution, where we're seeing earthquakes for the first time in areas that have never had an earthquake in their history. We said, let's just do the studies first. That moratorium never got any grip at all in the legislature. There was too much money behind the lobbies, and they pretty much gave it lip service by the Democrats, but they pushed it aside. They came up with this compromise bill. And I think this, Bob, is really where the cautionary tale has to be told again and again and again. Instead of just putting the brakes on and saying, wait a minute, if you push through this regulatory bill, it's going to have forever implications, long-lasting implications, please, please just stop what you're doing. And the big greens didn't. They worked a deal, a backroom deal. Only a handful of groups were represented in a series of negotiations between the gas and oil industry, the labor industry, the labor representative, and the governor's office, and four people from four different environmental organizations, none of whom live or represent anybody near the impacted areas, cut this backroom deal that ultimately led to the fiasco, which I wrote about today, is that the fracking rules are a mess.
And that seems to be a common thread in that, excuse me, these big green organizations, and you name them in your article, there's no harm in us mentioning it here, the Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and this organization, Faith in Place, heartbreaking element of this is that they constantly profess to be working on behalf of the people who have to live with this stuff, and yet time after time, you mentioned the AIC Act, and of course what you're talking about in Southern Illinois, they work in direct contravention of the people who have to live with this. You know what a struggle, well, it hasn't been a struggle. The Sierra Club just has no interest in the AIC Act whatsoever. What is it, Jeff, about this top, is it a top-down mentality? Is it a, we know better than the, where do they get the nerve?
You know, it's a good question, and I think we ask it even without any sense of, anger. I think it's almost being mystified.
Mystified and hurt, Jeff.
Yeah. I agree. And for example, Bob, the very same people who cut the deal on the fracking bill have now been appointed to a citizens task force on fracking by the governor. There's four so-called environmentalists on the task force, and all four people who represent four big green groups don't even live in the region. And so once again, it's like, the analogy I use in the article is if you were having a task force on Lake Michigan, for example, would people in Chicago be okay with it is if nobody in Chicago was on it and they only included people from Southern Illinois? Well, obviously not. That's absurd.
Or San Francisco and New York.
Right. And therefore, when you're determining the fate, the future, and the health of the children of people in Southern Illinois, and you don't even have a single person from Southern Illinois, not to mention not a single scientist or healthcare expert, but just paid lobbyists, it's absurd. And I think that's what we're asking. So why, how does it happen? I don't know. I mean, I think we both feel deep in our hearts that the people who work for these organizations believe they're doing good. They're good people. They're not the enemy. I feel like they truly believe in protecting the environment. They truly believe in clean energy alternatives. I just think they don't have the history. They don't have the empirical evidence and experience of living around extraction issues. They don't have the grandfather who coughed up his lungs from black lung, and they still know that three coal miners die daily from black lung disease, even though it's been regulated since 1969. They don't have that kind of sense of urgency. And so when push comes to shove, they get into the cozy circles of lobbyists in Washington or in Springfield or Charleston, West Virginia. And it suddenly becomes a little club, a little game. And the game is, how far can you get these bills? How much can we win? And we have to compromise. That's all part of the game. And at the end of the day, they sort of cut their losses and they walk away and they write their press releases and they can go home. And I think that to me, Bob, is the real problem here is that they just frankly don't realize that at the end of the day, where are you going home? In West Virginia, where are people from Illinois going home? Where are the people from Wisconsin who are being fracked sand mine now? And I think that's the problem, is that we don't have representation of these big environmental groups in the very areas that they need them. And it's just pretty sad.
I keep trying to look at it with all the tools in the toolkit that I've been given over the years. I've tried to analyze it particularly from a privileged position. Because Jeff, I don't like thinking that everything boils down to who has more cash, but the fact of the matter is, you and I have a dear friend, now gone, named Larry Gibson, who literally died weed-eating a mountain, what was left of his mountain in West Virginia, and had been made a hero by these big greens, and had possibly millions of dollars fundraised on his back, and the guy dies with a weed eater in his hand, for all intents and purposes. It seems like there's some ugly manifestations of privilege there. That as long as people who are working in the grassroots on the ground level are willing to toe the line and do what the self-appointed smart people tell them to do, well, that's great. But the minute and the AIC Act is an example of this. You know, we waited for years, Jeff, for somebody to come up with a bill in the Congress that would end mountaintop removal. And then after all that waiting, we took this emerging health data and marched off to Washington, D.C. and got it done ourselves. And still to this day, we're waiting for the people who claim to be our voices or for the people who claim to speak for the environment nationally in a couple of different organizations to step up and support what they say that they've been wanting all along. And you get nothing. I mean, it's crickets. And when I first started following the stories that you were publishing a year ago in Illinois, for a while we thought, maybe it's us. Maybe it's just hillbillies. But now I'm finding out, no, it's y'all. And it's people begging in Arizona. And it's people begging in Pennsylvania. And I guess the question, you know, I'm hoping that this article that you've written today at Huffington Post will serve as a kind of a wake-up call. Was that how you intended it?
Well, I mean, I've been ringing the wake up bell for a long time, Bob, as you know, and I'm not even sure it's being heard anymore. And I think, you know, I think that's the struggle now, is how to raise these issues without getting marginalized in the process. And it's been pretty hard. I mean, I feel like my role is to tell the truth, and it's not to go after any groups in particular. Once again, I consider these our friends.
Yeah, right.
But to tell the truth of what's going on, the damage it's creating, and how we need to rectify it. I try very hard in all my Huffington Post, if I call out a group, is to very much give the evidence, give both sides, but then also give an alternative, that instead of doing this, why aren't you doing that? You know, and for example, the Illinois Environmental Council gave an award, the top award a year, to the main fracker guy, the guy who passed the fracking regulatory bill, who's a total coal booster. He's awful, and yet now he's being held up as this kind of rock star for clean energy. It's very, very Orwellian out here in Illinois.
And you know that kind of thing happens all the time. I remember when the Humane Society of the United States gave its protector of its annual greatest protector of animals award to Nick Joe Rahal a couple of years ago, and I thought, I wonder how the bears and the deer and the fish and all the little critters that run around Central Appalachia feel about that award.
Yeah, and I blogged about that one too, Huffington Post. I'll never forget it. And I got an incredible backlash from wildlife friends in Washington who said, hey, you know, it's part of the deal. He's saving Alaska in the wilderness as part of the deal of mountaintop removal. And I was outraged that they were mad at me for calling them out. But
we have had people outraged at us before, but, you know, we had one of those about a year and a half ago. But it's stuff that has to be done, and you don't do it out of anger. You do it out of love and respect, frankly. And they don't, for some reason or another, they don't see it that way. You know, you mentioned frac sand mining in western Wisconsin, southeast Minnesota, northern Iowa, a few minutes ago. I got to see that for the first time up close, just driving down from Duluth to Eau Claire the other day. You know, Jeff, there are places where there are these great yellow mounds of sand sitting by railroads by the side of the road, and I thought, oh, my God, paint it black. It looks like home. And then I got to the room where we were speaking, and they had these pictures of mountaintop removal sites, and I thought, well, I'll be damned. Somebody blew up a bunch of mountaintop removal pictures just because they knew we were coming. Well, it wasn't mountaintop removal, Jeff. It was sand mines in western Wisconsin. that people right. keep begging and saying, please listen to us, and the smart people keep saying, no, 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 we know how to do it right. And I guess that's one of the questions at the end of the day is, why do we have, you know, you and I both know that this is a Pandora's box that once opened is seldom closed and is never closed before something awful has happened. I did notice, or just this evening when I was listening to the radio while I was running an errand, there are people in the Chicagoland area who are upset that some Koch Brothers tar sands coke is being piled up outside their neighborhood. And at one point they thought their neighborhood was on fire because all this dust was just blowing around in the air. And some spokeswoman from Koch Industries said, well, we're hosing it down with water cannons.
All right.
And we haven't seen yet whether this is going to work. Why is it that people living on the ground, whether it be Southern Illinois or Wisconsin or Appalachia, why is it we have to wait for them to make their mistakes first before we start looking for solutions? Because at least in Appalachia, Jeff, as you know probably as well or better than I do, that's 125 years worth of waiting we've been doing.
Right. Yeah, and the key word of solutions too is just it's completely been distorted. The clean energy movement, for example, is one of the few bright spots I think we've had in the past few years is creating solar and wind jobs, and they're 99.9% gone to people in non-extraction areas. Illinois ranked 7th in the nation in new clean green jobs, and not a single one of them is south of Springfield. They're all in Chicago or in the north. When the people who absolutely need them to transition from them, just like in West Virginia, need to be the people who are mining coal. And I think that's the other strange issue we're getting right now is that, you know, while we're also paying for the cultural and social backlash, economic backlash of the coal mine and essentially fracking, we also pay the backlash that there's no other economy being developed, no clean energy, no clean energy manufacturing, no wind turbine factories, no solar farms. And precisely in the areas that desperately need it. And that's been my other big battle is to try to get these people to realize, you know, I don't need you just to shut down the coal fire plant. That's wonderful. But I also need you to help us create some clean energy jobs.
In your article, you reference an activist by the name of Sam Stearns. Can you tell us a little bit about Sam Stearns? His looks like a really compelling story.
So Sam is the Larry Gibson of Illinois. He's almost like the Judy Bonds of Illinois. He's an incredible character. He's fearless, and he's legendary in the Shawnee Woods. He lives deep down in Polk County in the Shawnee National Forest. Been there all his life, third-generation coal miner. He's got family in the coal mines, Hungarian immigrants, I think, originally, probably a century ago. He decided not to work at the coal mines, worked on oil rigs, sort of a rustabout, came back, loved his woods, suddenly realized that they were logging the Shawnee National Forest in a way that was completely illegal. And, you know, the difference between being a nationally protected park and a national forest is that you can do logging, and it's quite a lucrative business. And so he wanted to protect some incredible areas. You know, Southern Illinois has a diversity that matches the Cumberlands or the Ozarks, especially in these few areas that have been saved. And Sam was one of the few people who stood in front of the chainsaws and the bulldozers. This is many, many years ago. Got arrested, led civil disobedience, was betrayed by the Sierra Club, who tried to cut a deal to allow X amount of logging. And he wanted a complete moratorium, and he won. He got to a magical place for us called Bellsmith Springs. It's one of the few incredible areas. We actually have 6 wilderness federally protected wilderness sites now. It's largely because of people like Sam who wouldn't take no for an answer and felt like we had to do whatever was necessary to protect these treasures and protect our community. He's fought tooth and nail with the Sierra Club ever since on just a series of things. You know, the Sierra Club cut a deal and allow the state to spray pesticides in our forest to get rid of invasive species, but at the same time, they could have gone a much more natural route. Sam has fought him on that. He's fought him on the coal mining regulation. And now he finds himself having to fight environmental groups, as well as the state, for fracking, because fracking is definitely going to be focused on these very fragile areas of southern Illinois, both with the county national forest and small communities that are not incorporated that, you know, drink water out of their wells. And so Sam has really emerged as this incredibly authentic voice out of the Shawnee, who is speaking, I think, to the needs of the people, someone who knows the history, he knows how the regulations work, he knows the machinations of the state, he knows how corrupt the agencies are, how corrupt the companies are, how corrupt local governments can be when a lot of money is thrown around, and he's willing to stand up to all these people. And so he's really emerged as one of the courageous few that I'm really trying to profile a lot. We just had an incredible victory. I'll be real quick here.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we had a website in Illinois that was for children about how wonderful coal was.
Oh, God.
And it was laughably pathetic. You know, it talked about, had this little lump of coal figure as a cartoon, and he said coal no longer polluted, and we have magical clean coal now, and reclamation is the same thing as making nature even better. And basically, it was just awful, awful propaganda that I think even would make people in the coal industry cringe.
It takes a lot.
And we took years to fight this darn curriculum that was handed out to all the teachers and students. We finally got the state to do an assessment. The assessment came out and said, yeah, it's pretty awful. Let's take another 2 years to think about it. And meanwhile, they had this horrible website. And we told everybody, let's get that website down. People can still access it. It's very offensive to coal miners as much as to people who live in coal mining areas. Nobody would touch it. Sam launched a petition with Credo and took off like wildfire. It shocked everybody. We got a lot of national attention. We plugged it big time, and within 14 days, the state pulled down the website.
I saw that as it happened, and that was a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and here it was that a single environmental mainstream group supported him. It was only grassroots people working with health groups and education groups and not environmental groups. And they basically were able to shame the state into doing, once again, a no-brainer. You just don't have this kind of information on a website that's paid for by public tax dollars. And I think that's what we need more of, is just people calling an ace, doing the right thing, calling people out, not in a way that...
No, we don't need Clint Eastwood music and gunfire in the streets. I mean, this is actually what this is a call. This is a call, Jeff, for these organizations to actually live up to their creeds and their mission statements.
Yeah, exactly.
And I took from Sam's words in your article that he is deeply frustrated, because now that these four individuals you mentioned earlier sat down and collaborated in the crafting of this god-awful piece of legislation in Illinois, lo and behold, now have I got it right now that they're turning around and saying Lord, Lord, that they're wringing their hands and saying that, gosh, we didn't know it was going to be this way.
And right. They engineered this bill, and then the bill passed, and so then the Department of Natural Resources has to write up the actual rules. And they're laughable. They literally, it was written, you know, overnight by some gas industry guy right at their hip pocket. And so here's the headline, Bob, on Sunday in the Chicago Tribune. Environmentalists feel betrayed. We're saying you feel betrayed. And I immediately called the Chicago Tribune and said, look, you know, there's more than just one environmentalist in Illinois. There's grassroots environmentalists, people who've been at this for decades. And to say that one group in Chicago feels betrayed is laughable. I mean, because here people have been betrayed for decades by these same people. And so to us, it was just the incredible example of hypocrisy. But once again, Southern Illinois is going to pay the price, not these people.
Right. Well, no, the price is all... Well, the price is always externalized onto someone else, whether it's someone not in Chicago or someone not in San Francisco, et cetera. One of the things that I really appreciate about the article as you've written it, Jeff, is that, as you've noted, you don't just say this is wrong. You provide a way forward with solutions. And I think one of the most important real-world do-it-now solutions is that those four unaffected individuals who sit on the advisory panels need to step down now. And there needs to be space made for affected citizens from affected communities. Do I have that right?
Yeah, exactly. And we're saying, literally, you have a moral obligation. You've just been appointed to be the Citizen Task Force. If you truly believe in healing the wounds of the environmental community, and that's a big sort of, you know, touchy-feely moment we have now, is we need to heal the wounds of the fracking debate. Well, if you're really serious about healing the wounds and bringing the groups together and uniting them, then you have a moral obligation to say, hey, I'm not going to serve on this task force until there's proper representation from impacted people. It's a pretty easy decision. It's the least they can do out of respect.
I'm just curious, how many of these four individuals, how many listening sessions have they held in Southern Illinois since their appointment?
Oh, well, they just got appointed just last week, but it's, that's just it.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm getting. Okay, I probably phrased that inelegantly. How many listening sessions have they held from the time that they were collaborating in the crafting of this god-awful bill until the present instant?
Oh, I mean, you can probably count them on one hand, maybe on one finger. I would say maybe one or two of them have come down for a couple of panels and sort of told us what's happening in Springfield, the capital. And it's not really a listening session. It's mainly they come down to tell us what's going on, and this is how it's going to be, and this is what you need to do. And that's it. I mean, I think you're hitting the point there, is that they haven't even come down to visit. They haven't even gone to, even more egregious to me is that these people haven't even taken the time to go visit fracking sites in other states. They haven't gone up to a frack sand mine in Wisconsin, which is, you know, hour and a half drive from us. They haven't been over to Ohio or Pennsylvania to see the mayhem. You know, they're negotiating from their little air-conditioned offices in Chicago and Springfield or Champaign-Urbana. And that, once again, is the thing that just, we've reached sort of a tipping point where we just can't take it anymore. I feel like, you know, I'm the conduit for the voices on the front lines who just say, you know, we just can't take it anymore, that these people are negotiating on our behalf. And half of them are very well-meaning, but really young people who, you know, just have no business being in this role.
And by that, may I elaborate by saying, not because they're young, but because they lack the body of experience and wisdom? Is that appropriate?
Yeah, they literally, you know, they just jumped into this issue a year and a half ago. And, you know, I think they could be working for the Cancer Society, or they could be working on gun control, or they could be working on immigration, or they could be working on whatever. This just happens to be the job they got hired to do straight out of college. And once again, they're very well-meaning, good people. But I think at a certain point, they need to have the wherewithal and the maturity. You know, they're essentially orchestrated by their national groups. It is just to step back for a moment and realize they need to listen to the people who've been at it for years. And I think, obviously, this resonates a lot with what's happening in West Virginia.
Well, I know you've only got a little bit more time, and as usual, you're on the road from one place to another. I have real sympathy with that, Jeff. But let me ask this just as a sort of a meta question for all of this coming out of those last remarks you made. Is there a fundamental systemic flaw here insofar as what is referred to as the environmental movement is now operating on the same sort of industrial paradigm where you go to college and you major in something that winds up being like nonprofit management or something like that, and you come out and you feel like you're automatically qualified to go in and tell affected communities what, you know, now see here, you people. Do you get what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the real parallel to me is the well-meaning kids who came down to West Virginia for the war on poverty and ended up becoming governors, is that, you know, they have a heart of gold, they want to do right, they're extremely articulate and well-trained, and they come out of college with that degree in some sort of administration, and they think they can change poverty overnight. They don't have a clue of the complexity, but also the decades, if not century, of resistance that has been fighting. And I think we know it with the poverty movement. You know, in Mingo County, I edited a book that came out, of course, that dealt with what happened there in the 60s and the 70s of well-meaning, but ultimately idealistic young poverty warriors that really became part of the problem. To people like Don West, you know, the great West Virginian poet and labor organizer who wrote an incredible pamphlet called Poverty Pays as Long as You're Not Poor. And Don really went after the same people that I think that we're having to have a reckoning with today. And it's these well-meaning outsiders who come in, who, as you say, sort of think they are trained and they know it all, they can work the system and gain the system, and they can write the grants, and they get the federal grants and the nonprofit grants, and, you know, and they either walk away after 2 years because they all get burned out, or they cut deals which they shouldn't be cutting that ultimately lead to a worse problem. And I think the environmental movement...
Or maybe they wind up making $250,000 a year being somebody's executive director.
Exactly. Or they go into politics or something.
Well, okay, then one final, because you do look for solutions, is it reasonable or rational or even sane to say that grassroots people around the country need to start put out a call for some sort of a reconciliation with the big greens?
Bob, I've really come to the point where I feel like, and we had a real moment last summer in Southern Illinois after the disaster of the fracking bill when it passed through, and I was there sitting in the Capitol, and when one state rep after another got up and said, I'm voting for this bill because the Sierra Club's supporting it. And then to see Sandra Steingraber, the great biologist who's a native of Illinois, who's become really the famous toxic avenger, cancer survivor, to see her stand up and scream into that chamber, you have betrayed us. You have betrayed the children of Illinois. You betrayed our health and our environment. It struck me hard.
I watched the video that you provided, and it had the same effect that even at great distance.
Yeah, that Sandra was basically the mode of these old abolitionists who spoke about truth and who were fearless and courageous and called an ace an ace. And, you know, as we all know, the emancipation movement had all sorts of divisions. And I felt like what I was learning from Sandra, and I think what I've learned from history as a historian, is I'm not going to spend my time going after these people, but perhaps I need to spend my time more of finding the Sam Stearns, the Bob Kincaids, you know, the Bo Webbs, the people who are standing up and really get the voice, the focus back to the courageous people who are speaking the truth. And I think that's the role we need to play now, is to get to the funders, to get to the media. And part of my article today was to say, you know, you need to be talking to the right people and stop quoting this person when they don't represent that region, and stop appointing these people if they don't represent that region. And I feel like it's almost hopeless to keep going after these big green groups, because I feel like they're caught up in this kind of whirlpool and they're never going to get out of it. And we almost need to go around them now and create a movement. You remember what Don West said? He said in 1970, he said, if you look at the spoils of strip mining around us, we have to come to the conclusion that no one is going to save ourselves but ourselves until we make our own stand. And I think Don West knew it then in the 60s and 70s. That's
the space the AIC Act came from. That's the space that this grassroots activism in Illinois is coming from. And I think, you're right, Jeff. And the question becomes one of brainstorming the how part.
Right.
It's been a long time since you and I have sat down over a cup of coffee. I hope I hope we can begin that. I hope we can begin that discussion, because it takes place in central Appalachia. It takes place in southern Illinois. It takes place in Arizona. It takes place, it takes place with the grassroots communities that have the proposal of these god awful Powder River Basin coal trains polluting their lives just because they happen to live near the railroad tracks. There's plenty of space open for this conversation. And maybe it is time to just go around.
Yeah, and I think, and for us to be smarter and more dynamic and more courageous, and because you know what, Bob, I think they're becoming increasingly, they play a role. They do good work, but I think they're becoming increasingly irrelevant in the bigger picture. I think at a certain point we felt we had a certain influence on the Obama administration, and I think that was made quite clear very quickly that we don't. It's not like any of the big greens can crack the whip and get the EPA or anybody to listen to them. I think what we've realized is they don't really have that much power. You know, they're not going to save us. And you know what? I feel fine. Because I know who's going to save us. It's going to be the people on the front lines who are going to stand up. And once again, that's why I'm giving a lot of attention now to people like Sam Stearns, is because he's defended our forests from the loggers, from the pesticides, from the coal miners, and now from the frackers. And I'm willing to step over that line and be with people like him and say, you know, these are the people ultimately we have to side with. And that's exactly what you and your incredible ranks are doing in West Virginia. And people are watching, Bob. Should never feel like what you guys do is not being watched. People definitely admire just the incredible resilience and perseverance and inspiration of what you guys are doing.
So, well, thank you, Jeff, and thank you for everything that you do. Go wherever it is you are going, go safely, and I hope we'll talk soon. And thanks again for putting this article out there this evening.
Thanks for having me on, Bob. Do great work. Take care.
You do too, Jeff. Bye now. Award-winning author and cultural historian Jeff Biggers, calling from the road. You know, I read the article kind of late in the day and just dropped an email to him, and lo and behold, like 15 minutes before airtime, and lo and behold, Jeff was there even as we were rolling the intro music to get this information out. And it has, as I hope you can see, a broad application. It's not just central Appalachia. It's not just southern Illinois, even though there's no such thing as just central Appalachia or just southern Illinois or just anywhere else, because these are all magnificent communities. For me to sit there in Eau Claire, Wisconsin on Friday night to a standing room only crowd, And they were presented, it was not about me. It is never about me. I don't want it to be about me. I don't ever want to be the person who says, "Now see here, you people," because I'm about up to my nostrils in "Now see here, you people." It's gotta be the will and the desire of the communities. But there was new information to be taken about these ultrafine particulates. People wanted to hear it, and they went away, I think, in possession of, see how easy it is to get into eliminationist language because I almost said armed with. No. They went away in possession of information that can be critical to their continued decent survival. Because the blasting is going on, the impacts on water are going on, and I hope at some point in time to have Dr. McCauley on here just to talk about these ultrafine particles with the Horn Family Commune, because it is information that has broad relevance. It doesn't just happen in Appalachia, or it isn't just, no, wherever somebody wants to set off explosions in order to get at something that they want to sell for money to someone else and be damned anybody who lives near it, this stuff is relevant. And there, you know, there are overarching issues regarding the EPA. You know, the EPA has particulate regulations. It's called PM10 and PM2.5. Neither of those are even remotely relevant to the issues. They're not. Just not. So, Jeff referenced having gotten in trouble here and there. Don't anybody tell the Sierra Club and NRDC and those folks that we had this conversation tonight, or somebody will call me in and tell me once more, Bob, you can't criticize the club. I think that would be time number 6 that I've been told you can't criticize the club. Because, see, that's their job. Their job is to lead the stupid hillbillies. Because, you know, we're not smart enough to do anything for ourselves, even though we got the first bill ever introduced that would end mountaintop removal, which they're still not supporting, which should, as Jeff Biggers says, be a no-brainer. So we have all of that to consider. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff to go into this evening because, well, I've been away from the microphone since Thursday, Friday, yesterday. And I guess we'll just have to let some of the... And there were some choice morsels in those 3 days. And we'll have to let a lot of them go by the boards, but there's some that we won't. And just to let you know, first of all, I want to extend my profound thanks to the Pinocchio Hills Education Project for getting me up there, for inviting us up there to... Northern Wisconsin, as well as helping provide the forum at the University of Wisconsin Eau Claire. I can never thank them well enough. And I hope that we I know Dr. McCauley did a magnificent job, but I hope we did a good job of not being the now see here you people. Because coming away, I always... It's kind of a... Let's see. On the way out, it was Charleston to Atlanta, Atlanta to Minneapolis, Minneapolis to Duluth. That was Thursday. Then Friday was drive from Duluth to Eau Claire. And then Saturday was drive from Eau Claire to Ashland. And then I had Sunday to go out into the Pinokies themselves in the company of my dear friend Bill. Got to spend a little time talking with an amazing human being, my buddy Pete. Saturday night we had a room full at Northland College in Ashland, and absolutely one of those things I will never forget. A beautiful potluck dinner was put on for us on Saturday evening before the event at Northland College. A potluck was put on for us at on the Bad River Reservation. They brought in a magnificent drum group called the Bucks. You can find them on Facebook, THABUCKS. And it was transformative. And if you're open to the essential goodness of people just wanting to protect their homes, you can't help but be transformed, changed, moved by being even remotely included in the process. The dinner was beautiful. There was a big pot of locally gathered and processed wild rice. Mel up at the harvest camp in the Pinokies sent me away from there with 2 big Ziploc bags full of wild rice, and I'm sitting here practically counting out every grain, figuring out what to do, which way to, and I learned some stuff about wild rice, how to cook it, different things to do with it. None of it will soon be forgotten. I sat in a 21st century wigwam in the Pinokies and heard the song of strong winds blowing above while inside the structure that's based on 10,000-year-old construction principles, never a breeze was felt. It was toasty warm. And it was mighty good. I got to meet with the farm family out in direct line of sight of where these people want to destroy a community in order to make themselves money, because people like Chris Klein have not yet figured out that they don't hook U-Hauls behind hearses. And the welcome was simply total and all-encompassing. I met people up there that I had not met before. I met a brilliant poet who's going to get to read his works that he writes there on the shores of Lake Superior. He's going to get to read his work at City Lights Books in San Francisco. Wow. Just wow. And we got to talk a lot about the rest of the... Well, not the rest of the threat, but understanding the totality of the threat. And they were tremendous conversations. And by the way, if you go to IndianCountryTV.com, IndianCountryTV.com, there is a video that you can play at your leisure of the Ashland meeting at Northland College. IndianCountryTV.com. So that's just a little bit of an overview. Oh, by the way, and I haven't even had a chance to tell my buddies back up in northern Wisconsin this yet. They'll get a big laugh out of it. Apparently, wild rice, native gathered and native processed, is a potential security risk. Going through security, my backpack, which had my bags of wild rice tucked in the bottom of it, lit up the, and so I had to get my bag searched. And that's always a little bit nerve wracking. I knew the most dangerous thing in there was probably a lifesavers, because my blood sugar plummets sometimes, so I always make sure there's some kind of something in there to keep it. Yeah. And there's a tablet and a couple of fountain pens and a couple of traditional notepads, my journal, things like that. And we're going to need to search your bag, sir. Okay. Whatever makes you happy. You're the guy with the gun and the handcuffs and the badge, and I'm just little old me. Search away. Anything in this bag could potentially hurt me, sir? No. Don't think so. Pretty sure not. And then, so he goes through and then says, this appears to be, do you have seeds down here or something? I've got some wild rice that my Ojibwe friends gave me. Oh, okay. That makes sense. And he looks in there. Yep, definitely wild rice. Sets it off all the time. So just if you happen to be traveling from the Northwoods and you happen to have been given some wonderful wild rice as a gift and you tuck it into your carry-on and you're not paying $40 or something to ship it through checked baggage, don't be surprised when they pull you over and search your wild rice, because it could potentially be frightening wild rice. We are a coward people. C-O-W-E-R-E-D. We are a coward people. We are huddling in water-boweled fear of everything that goes bump in the night, and even some things that taste good with a little bit of meat and some onions and some, wild rice. Well, it's wild, isn't it? Mercy sakes. So here we come to the end of the first hour of tonight's conversation. And it is, after all, conversation radio, right? That means you play a big part in it. 304-658-3333 is the number. That's the regular old telephones, but if you want to jump in on the Skype line, that is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. And now, not having mentioned it for, look at me, 56 minutes, I will tell you that we are badly behind in fundraising. Thank you to Sal for getting us started this evening, and thank you to Thomas for his help yesterday. And we had more help along the way over the weekend, so that the fundraising is not as terrifyingly bad as it otherwise might be. And I want to make sure that everyone does, in fact, get thanked. Some folks have subscriptions, and they have, and that makes things really convenient, I hope, on both sides of the equation. But what it boils down to is we are about, the hole is about $380 deep right now. Yeah, seriously, thanks to Sal, thanks to Khalil, thanks to Thomas. Thank you indeed, one and all. 38 folks at $10 a piece isn't too terrible a hole. Maybe we could crawl out of that. And that would put us even for beginning tomorrow evening with the usual evening's $150. So, PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. The traditional mail address is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y-W-V, 25801. Remember, checks, money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but should, in fact, be made payable to Head On Communications, The Horn, something like that. And thank you, one and all, for those of you who participate either one way or the other. And without getting too full of myself, because that's not my goal, I will simply say that I'm not sure, but I bet that I am, that we here in this community we have created are one of, if not the first people to hear on a broadcast basis in a long-form conversation, Jeff Biggers talking about the giant sellout in Illinois, and what's worse, the terrific mess the smart people have made, but alongside providing some potential solutions. If one is going to raise a complaint, it is always good to present a solution. So I encourage you to go over to Huffington Post, look up Jeff Biggers. The name of the article, again, Fracking Illinois, Two Are Things We Know For Sure. It was published today at 3:43 p.m. Eastern Time, so it should be easily found. Go and share it around. Help build it a little bit of juice so other people will see it. Because I think the one thing that comes out of everything that Jeff was saying, and it is he says it more eloquently than I, but you heard him. The Sierra Club has become irrelevant. If we are going to save ourselves from these problems in our various and sundry parts of the country, you know what? We're going to have to do it by ourselves, for ourselves. Because I don't know what they're doing with their money, but they're not helping anybody in the grassroots, these big greens. And it's a damn shame. But, as Michael once said, or actually, no, as Abe Vigoda once said, it's only business, right? So break time and light up the phones. It's been a while since we talked. I'm looking forward to the conversations. 304 658-3333. This is the horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Sorry about messing up the groove, Isaac. Just got a tweet from Isaac at Bob Kincaid. That's the Twitter handle, by the way. You're messing up the groove, Bob. Well, yeah, there might be a little buffering there because I'm uploading Dr. Bill's file so Ben Birch can get it at his earliest convenience. And as much as I love the groove, I get more complaints when I mess up the conversation portion of the program. So that's why. This is The Horn. It is the 19th of November, 2013. Thanks to Duncan for putting up the link to the Northland College Ashland event this past Saturday night, courtesy of IndianCountryTV.com and my good friend Paul Demain, who broadcasted it. Go and check it out. It's on my Facebook page, Bob Kincaid. It's right there if you want to go and look for it. Let's go to the phones, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
Well, we'll get to that later. Yeah, this is quite interesting tonight that Jeff came up with that, because it's about time somebody got something published. Yeah, I don't know how much is being said about these people and these frackers and how they're... Man, these guys are spreading like, you know...
Well, you know, the problem, Bill, is that a lot of people are talking about fracking, and it's almost as though we cannot walk and chew gum at the same time, because it seems that we can't talk about all of this extreme... these extreme assaults on human communities without focusing on one at the expense of the other. You know, a few years ago, for instance, mountaintop removal was a really big deal. And then the entire so-called environmental community kind of went, hey, look, fracking. And they all ran away, and we weren't a big deal anymore. And that's not jealousy. That, 'cause I worry about people in frack communities or frack sand communities. Or whether it's Southern Illinois, Southwest Wisconsin, God knows Pennsylvania has turned into a fracking wild west. What's going on in the upper reaches of North Dakota ought not have to, ought not happen. And yet we seem only to be able to talk about one thing at a time. And the other problem is what Jeff alluded to, Bill, and that is that they're talking to the extent it's being talked about at all. The media are talking to the wrong people. The Sierra Club has nothing to say about fracking that matters to people, as we obviously see in these communities being affected by it. They collaborated and connived at making it happen in Illinois, and they got a history of doing this stuff. But lo and behold, we'll go to somebody from some media outlet will go to a person from one of these big greens to ask the experts what those people down there ought to be thinking, and that's one of the most essential problems with the whole thing.
Well, I've had this opinion sometimes. A lot of these people are bandwagoning on different situations to raise money for their own existence.
Absolutely, because because it's an industry now.
Yeah,
I mean, you go to college. You're really smart, and you bust your little butt for 4 years, and you get some sort of a nonprofit management degree. And the next thing you know, you're out there telling the peasants what they ought to be thinking and feeling.
Yep, I've had close people.
And you're being paid well to do it too, Bill.
Yes, close people to me who got involved in the drug and alcohol fighting area, on paper, fighting it. But also, I remember, my second wife, Stanton, studied what areas was the money going to be at for people who had degrees in certain areas and knowledge in certain areas. Go shop around and see where the government is spending money. And she got into the anti-alcohol and drug thing about 30 years ago or more. Because there was a lot of money flowing in that direction. And is it really the issue and the overall extent of these different situations? Or is it just let me get a job where the money is and I'll pretend to be doing something.
Hey, look, you know, if you can, there aren't a whole lot of $125,000, $150,000 a year jobs out there. And if you can, you know, if you can get one with one of these big greens and pretend and think you're doing something for society, and sort of live in a little bubble where you all tell each other, you know, you're saving the planet, you know.
I guess I was stupid. I never figured out about the. We were taught find something you enjoy doing, and it's not work. It's something you enjoy. It'll be so easy that blah blah blah. And they keep coming up with new and better ways of screwing the public for a buck. These same people. One of my best friends who grew up in the projects with me, he was talking about this fracking type stuff 30 years ago as a way to make money. He's always been on the cutting edge of where industry was going. He was involved in working for one of the big transportation companies, and then he tied up with a outfit in Atlantic City to start hustling people down to occupy the floors of these new gambling places. You know, where they give people a meal ticket and a bus ride down to occupy the floor and make it look like it was busy in the beginnings of the Atlantic City thing.
Sure.
And he's all in favor of this fracking, and you can't talk to these people because it's the same thing. They can smell the money. And all this stuff also does, well, I suppose within a reason, like finding more natural gas. That in itself, in the old traditional ways, could be bad enough, but natural gas probably beats the hell out of coal as far as keeping you warm.
In terms of BTUs actually devoted to whatever, yeah, because the best that coal can ever muster is about, 31 to 33% of the BTU, the thermal potential of coal, actually goes toward its purpose. Most of it goes up a stack.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, in other words, there are things that we need to keep society going. And in this climate, a certain amount of heat in the wintertime by itself. Not speaking about the industrial usage of different things, but just the, believe me, Bob, I did enjoy having a fireplace and wood cut to put in it, as it got to this time of year. But, because what else do you do as a human being? But it's the way that they do things, too. This friend of mine sold property down near the arsenal near Warren. She has, they approached her and they sent her some money. And then about 2 weeks ago, they backed out on the whole deal. And to me, knowing these people, 2-1, they went looking for it on the basis of this down. They didn't come up with something, so they don't want to pay anymore. And they've already done some, because I don't know what you know about this whole thing, but how can they get in there and look for stuff? And how, the slant drilling and the such things that they can do that you have no idea they're doing. And they don't come up with something, so they're not going to give you they make you a deal on paper, And then they back off on paying half of it. It's bad enough what they're doing, but the way they do business is even rotten.
Right.
And because I know you've seen your home state just ravaged by this stuff. And we went through it here with the strip miners who left behind them on paper a lot of beautiful ponds and such in southern Ohio, in southeastern Ohio, where now the fishermen go and work and have fun, and these leftover... Hell, along the freeways, there was big ponds here and there along the interstates. But what the hell? What do we do to stop them, Bob? Because I hate to be nice.
Well, in a way, I think these big greens have given people an excuse not to be active. You understand why I would say that?
Yeah.
The Sierra Club's taking care of that. Oh, the Natural Resources Defense Council has that under control.
Yeah.
And as long as all you got to do is sit home and get one of their, oh, my God, I still can't believe they're putting them out, Save the Wolves emails, where if you send them $15, they'll personally save a wolf for you. And if you believe that, they'll also save you a unicorn and a Pegasus, too. Then you are absolved from having to get off of your seat and onto your feet and into the street.
Yeah, I listen to an outdoor show every Sunday morning, which is pure pleasure for me, the fishermen talking, and I've learned a lot. They have great recipes for stuff, too, which is the sideline. But there was a situation, I think last weekend, where a kid was bitten in Chicago by a coyote. And I know in an area of Cleveland Heights, there's a big park named after John D. himself, because it was part of John D.'s land, you know. Rockefeller Park, they call it. And a friend of mine was walking his dog up there about 6-7 years ago, and there's coyotes. And this is, man, this is inner city stuff, you know? Inner ring suburbs. It's close to downtown.
Yeah.
And the airport, the lakefront airport, anywhere there's desolation, those guys are showing up again. And I've got nothing against them, but, you know, meantime, they're destroying, this fracking is bad news. It's not, what are they doing to the center of the earth, Bob? What are they doing to the hollow of the earth?
Well, I mean, they're not going that far. The crust is thicker than they are drilling, but they're going down about a mile.
Yeah.
And then they start going horizontally.
Yeah.
And what they're doing that we know so far, Bill, is they are causing the occasional earthquake.
Yeah.
They are B, fouling water left and right.
Yep.
C, they are, I hope someone will email you the link to the talk from Wisconsin so you can listen to it.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that, yeah.
And they are also putting these poisonous ultrafine particles into the air.
Yeah, the amount of poison they're shooting into the ground, it's got to be getting into the water table. And
it is. And hey, here's a fun one. I read an article as I was on the way home. I think it was yesterday. You know, the largest volcanic caldera in North America is right underneath Yellowstone National Park, right?
Yeah.
And that's why Old Faithful is there. Well, there are places in Yellowstone where the land is moving upwards inches per year, not inches per decade or per century,
wow,
but per year. Now, out in that neighborhood, and by the way, let me just put it out there, that when, not if, when that volcano goes active, it's going to be what is referred to as a super volcano. It's not just going to do a little Mount St. Helens, because that's what, as big as Mount St. Helens was, it's going to be a hiccup compared to Yellowstone. Okay, so what's happening not too awfully far in the grand scheme of things from Yellowstone? Why, look, fracking. The people who cause her, you know.
Yeah.
We bring you earthquakes. We're frackers. So, of course, what often goes hand in hand with volcanic activity? Earthquakes.
Yeah.
So when the earth moves and gets sideways and rumbles, it's kind of like a, oh, wow, this is really gross, but, you know, volcanoes are zits on the face of the earth. And volcanic eruptions are, well, you get the idea. I don't want to be any more graphic than that. But we're talking about an eruption that would challenge the ability of the United States to go on being the United States and portions of Canada to go on being portions of Canada. We're talking about feet and feet of volcanic ash falling, you know, within Denver. okay?
Just wiping out the big cities.
You know, Helena, Laramie, reaching maybe as far as well, you know, certainly probably Pierre and Fargo and like that. But, you know, people who frack don't give a frack.
No.
Because they're making money and they're job creators, right?
Well, and such jobs as they do create for the average guy are pretty short-term situation, isn't it, Bob? Comparatively speaking, with the production of a product.
Yeah. And by the way, an interesting statistic, and I hope I have no reason to believe it's not true. All the hydrocarbons on Earth combined produce the energy that the sun produces in 20 days.
So the correct answer would be solar.
Sure, and wind.
And wind. I don't know. Wind has some problems. Remember, I was never inclined towards science because I just didn't have the interest in it for some reason.
Oh, and by the way, Jeremy in Vermont just sent me a quick message. When the Yellowstone supervolcano blows, anything 1,000 miles or less from it will be under 11 feet of ash and done.
Ooh. I think there was one in my lifetime. Wasn't there an eruption? I think there was. I know, of course, the one out west. But when the old timer, what was his name, Truman?
Huh.
He wouldn't leave?
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't have to worry about that now, does he?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
By the way, the most active volcano in Mexico is getting a little froggy lately, Popocatépetl. Under whose shadow the teeming millions of Mexico City live. I think Mexico City is still the largest city in the entire world in the shadow of that volcano. And of course, they're hard to predict. But you don't want to go doing things that are going to make it easier.
You see, there's a real philosophic question here, Bob. Is just what do we do to stay warm, to produce food, the things that the basic necessities of life.
But see, and that's a good question, Bill, and I'm glad you asked it because, well, I'm not the answer guy. But
no.
I can tell you something based on an observation that I had just over this weekend. You know, I was honored to go up into the La Couderay harvest camp in the Pinokies. You know, the native peoples up there have treaty rights to hunt and gather fish on lands that they ceded by treaty to the nation.
Don't tell they're reneging on them.
They've moved in to assert their hunting and gathering rights there in the Pinokies, where that money grubbing hillbilly Chris Klein wants to destroy things.
Yeah.
But I sat in a timber framed wigwam in cold temperatures, and hell, I could have stripped down to my skivvies and I'd still been warm. Okay, it's timber framed. It was insulated with blankets and tarps. But you know the old ways, and the guy who had built it told me. He said the blue plastic tarps that he was using were temporary because he planned to use the old technologies and make a skin of birch bark and stitch it together, cover the structure. And then coated in pitch with resins from pine trees and bear grease.
Now that's human nature, where you have something to do, you have something to do with, and you learn to do with what you have to make it work for you. And man, I'm lost in that area of life. I mean, and I don't get I didn't used to get lost too easy, but And I say, for instance, I covered my butt in the wintertime by having heaters on my car engines, stuff that I learned from articles about International Falls, Minnesota.
Yep.
I mean, there's things out there. But here, the correct thing to do is to go back how far? To come up with an idea.
Well, I mean, we know that this is, again, and maybe I'm preaching, I'm not trying to, but we know, for instance, that the most successful civilizations in pretty much world history lived on the American, the Western Hemisphere, because in 1491, before the Europeans arrived, this was the most populous part of the entire planet, and it was not populated full of people wringing their hands and saying, oh, woe is me. It was populated by people who were living successfully in massive numbers. The Tenochtitlan of 1491 was one of the largest cities in the world. It was bigger than London. It was bigger than Seville. It was bigger than Florence or Rome. It was bigger than Paris. It was bigger.
Yeah.
Now, naturally, the Spaniards felt compelled to destroy it. But it was feeding a massive population, and that's city dwelling. You know, that's not living in a timber framed dwelling in the Northwoods. But that was successful living too. You know, that was one of the things that dawned on me the first time I saw Lake Superior, the first time I set my eyes on it. I don't think I could stand living next to the Great Lakes, because my mind would be turning ever outward, thinking about it. But I think Dr. John and I had a conversation about this. When the people arrived on the shores of Lake Superior, once they already had the technology to essentially solve the problem of how do we live in cold weather, because temperature extremes are always the first thing that human beings have to solve.
Yeah, you're going to react quickly to those, aren't you?
And once you've got that solved, well, when you look at everything that was in that area, it wasn't just the necessities for survival. It was the bounty for a joyful life.
Yeah.
You know, my heart beat a little bit faster. I think my blood pressure went up a little bit. The little hairs stood up on the back of my neck. And I know for a fact that my eyes filled with tears, Bill, when the drum group began drumming there at that potluck. Because I was hearing something that was at least 10,000 years old.
Yeah.
And had been preserved even unto the current generation, despite the most concerted efforts of the missionary church, of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, of the predations of explorers and conquerors and trappers, through an actual genocide, this had been hung on to. You know, this isn't like some other traditions that sort of got awakened and reimagined in the 19th century. This is stuff that exists in an unbroken line 10,000 years at least.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, like, how far are we going to go with the conveniences of what our lifestyle is? You know, how far can we go with this stuff before it all comes crashing down on top of us? Is another question.
And I think that question is well placed, Bill. But in asking that question as well, let's remember we have some tangential, you know, as working stiffs, as poor people,
yeah,
as people who are not, you know, in the 1%. We have an impact. We go and we buy our gasoline. We turn our light switches on. We do all these things. But we are doing it on a survival basis,
yeah.
Whereas the 1% types, the Koch brothers, the Chris Kleins, are doing it on a predatory basis.
They can't get enough. That's just something that my pure puny brain, Bob, I have a hard time understanding people who can't get enough.
Well, yeah, because I remember when when Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign got full underway, I was reading Dave Zirin today writing about the death of Len Bias, who would have been 50 years old today, which blew my mind.
Yeah, that's right.
Or something along that. I think that maybe. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong about the exact number. But anyway, that the death of Len Bias, he notes, catapults this Just Say No program of Nancy Reagan's, but it does so in a sort of oblivious manner. And suddenly we got all this science out there about how cocaine is terrible because laboratory mice fed cocaine will continue to consume the cocaine until they die, and this was, you know, all about the addictive qualities of cocaine, and everybody just caught fire with all, really, they'll just use the cocaine till they die. And that was the awareness building that went around that. But you know what? The Chris Kleins and the Koch brothers and the Don Blankenships and the Michael Bloombergs, despite his $50 million gift to the Sierra Club, and the other people that ride that tiny fraction of human population that ride our backs, Bill, you know what? They will consume money until they kill not themselves, but all of us, because just like they said about cocaine, you can never get enough of it.
Yeah, and believe me, I saw that was one weakness I did not have, Bob. I just couldn't see it, because mainly the stuff that I can still tell you without taking my shoes off, I can count the number of times I ever snorted the crap, and that's unusual when you're working in that environment. Because I was around, that stuff hit hard here through the 70s and 80s, real hard in the bars that I worked.
Oh, I was in Atlanta in the late 80s, and you just about had to put your snowshoes on to go out on Saturday night.
And I was with somebody, I actually sat and smoked some of it with a woman one time, and I couldn't wait to get out of the place, because she wanted to go buy more. She had got a shipment of...
Oh, dear God. Well, you know, that's what Robin Williams said. He said, the problem with cocaine is it makes you feel like a new man. But 30 minutes later, the new man wants a bump.
Yeah. That was stuff that I started messing around with. Bob, we used to break open Vicks inhalers and throw the cotton in a cup of coffee. I mean, this is something I must have done two or three times. I can't say that it wasn't an my addiction that's going to kill me is that damn tobacco. And that's going to kill me. There's no doubt about it. I still like cigarettes. And, hell, you know, it put me in a world of trouble right now with the cigarette butt. So what the hell? But it just depends how far can these people go, because they'll keep doing it, not for the further of mankind, but bringing mankind to a closer end. And when I tell people about your situation down there with the drinking water, they look at me like I'm lying. They can't believe it, no matter what. And as I say, a girl I know who did sell some people to go fracking, they all of a sudden they paid her half of it and backed off on the other half and left her hanging because she needed the money. But I don't know. They just, you know, human nature, we're just, I don't have one of the great minds of our times. I may know a little of this and a little of that, but by golly, I'm, you know, I never lived up to it in school either because I just didn't want to. It was too much work. And the only thing I can say is that one of my dad's pet sayings was, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Is that one you've heard before?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And
you can set that right next to that line from Ecclesiastes about there is nothing new under the sun.
Yeah, that's true. Because the bottom line is the pursuit of the dollar. And if this fracking would, let's say it would bring us to the kind of employment that we knew 30 years ago, the income level of the whole country, that's one, the only positive thing that it could do. but it's never going to do that again. Because these guys have got the economic system. Remember we talked years ago how good one world would be?
Yeah.
Well, I don't see it. It's this.
Well, and it's not there for a very good reason. And it's those same people who can't get enough.
Yeah, exactly. I can't believe that if Mao Zedong were to walk through China, he'd be, him and Jesus would be swatting people left and right.
Well, but okay, you said the magic word and the duck just dropped down.
Yep.
I had tremendous eye-opening conversations about China over the weekend. And an individual who was there for months on end doing scientific research told me that in all the time he was in China, and this was even years ago now, he said, I was all over the country. And he said, in all the time I was in China, you know what the largest wild animal I saw was?
Mm.
And I'm thinking, you know, bobcat, maybe, well, not possums, but yeah, something along, right?
Yep.
I said, what? He said, sparrow.
Jesus Christ.
He said, in the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, and the industrialization, they have eaten everything alive.
Yeah. I said, like, what is the answer for overpopulation? Tell people, stop having sex. Because
we know what the answer to overpopulation is,
yes,
Bill.
Yes, birth control.
Well, no, it's even simpler than that. Birth control is a means to an end.
Yeah.
The key to an overpopulated planet, and it has been scientifically observed and proven time after time after time after time, is the simple act of letting women determine when and if they will have children.
Yeah.
You see smaller family sizes in every community, whether it be wealthy or poor, whether it be Asian or European or African or one of the American cultures. You see women, when given the choice about giving birth, choosing to have smaller families.
Yeah.
In a lot of these cultures where women have no access to birth control, sex isn't sex so much as it is rape.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Bob, I fathered a child. It was 66. Yeah, she was born 67. And her mother was from a wealthy family of people in one of the suburbs. She thought hanging out with her, you know, so to speak, no pun intended, with a guy who was who everywhere she went with him and he played, people responded to real strong in the early days because they hadn't heard it done before. Believe it or not, I mean, the average, as I've talked to one of our family members about this, that, you know, people in my age group and time group had not heard much of what the kind of stuff I did, and they were kind of interested in. And there was, man, folk singers were all over the place, like, all over the, it was bringing the cultural level up to some degree. And, I never, as much as I saw of the past, I couldn't see the future. I mean, I knew that if we produced too many of us and we wanted everything that everybody else had, it was kind of a hard thing to do. But my God, when every time you turn on, I mean, I've never seen, Bob, I don't watch much TV. But I have never heard more commercials for automobile insurance than I hear today. I don't remember hearing them when I was a kid. And hell, when you got a car when you were my age and you got your vehicle, insurance for a kid, a boy, a young man under 27, was $700 a year. Now, this was in old money, too.
Yeah.
This is when you could rent a hell of a nice, my first wife and I were renting an apartment. It was a real nice apartment for $125 a month. And, The cost of living has gone sky high, as I'm telling you, which you know. And like this gasoline thing, Bob, you think the price of gas is based on the shortage or based on the ability to squeeze it out of you?
The latter.
Yeah.
But there's also an element of the former as well, Bill, because we know from peak energy curves, peak coal, peak oil, peak gas, peak whatever, that the harder it gets to obtain, the more expensive it becomes.
Yeah.
And that never, there's no let up in it until it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, I cannot imagine a scenario whereby we wind up with dollar a gallon gas ever again.
No, you never see it again.
You know, you go to Kuwait, maybe you can get 15 cent a gallon gas, but a loaf of bread is $30.
Yeah.
Now I'm just speaking off the cuff there, but that kind of thing. Yeah. And by the way, Sandra reminds me via Twitter, everything I was saying about giving women control of their own bodies, she noted, also known as empowering women, which is exactly what it is.
And that goes against the grain of most of the world's organized, quote, religion, doesn't it?
Right, and there's a whole bunch of the globe that would have to completely re-understand itself in order to stop understand it, because it still prevails, in order to stop understanding women as property instead of human beings. You know, if there's a culture out there where a marriage is arranged that is based on some barter of your daughter for his amount of property or cash or whatever,
yeah,
then it's still a property transaction. And that's one of the fundamental problems with these bilious idiots who holler about, we want to preserve the traditional marriage. Because the traditional marriage...
They forget to leave off. I want to be the boss.
Yeah. Well, and they also fail to note to those of us that the traditional marriage they're trying to preserve is essentially based in a property transaction in which women were deemed to be something short of fully actualized human beings. So when, and you know, it's kind of weird, but it's not if you just sort of scratch the surface of our own culture. It's weird to be talking about, in the 21st century, acknowledging that women are human beings. I mean, what? Not? Yeah, let me go tell the human beings in the front room, you know what? I won't quit running for a week.
There are people of both genders that I have a problem with. Are they human beings? Some of them. A whole bunch of them wear very expensive male suits, and, it's human nature is what it is, and some people seem to be more openly aggressive than others.
Well, look, I'll be completely candid. I have a hard time seeing the Koch brothers or Chris Klein or Don Blankenship or any of these other energy predators as human beings.
Yeah.
Mainly because they are apparently genetically human, but their brains are so badly damaged that they are sociopaths. I have no doubt whatsoever that if you plopped, say, because after being up in Wisconsin for a few days, Chris Klein is at the forefront of my mind, and I despise the very air he breathes. If you plopped him down in front of a psychologist and started asking questions and checking off boxes, and of course we can always refer to horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner for this, I think he'd confirm what I'm saying. It would come back that, yes, indeed, Chris Klein is a sociopath, because the essential definition of sociopaths, among other things, is that they have no conscience whatsoever, and they act only and always in their own interests, no matter the detriment to anyone else. And that being conscienceless, they are even unable to conceive of detriment to someone else. I mean, it just doesn't register. It's not on the scale. That's why they can go into a place like, you know, Appalachian communities or southern Illinois where Chris Klein's made a mess, or propose making a mess in northern Wisconsin. And they can say, yeah, but we're going to bring you some jobs. Oh, goody, I'm going to make enough with my job to pay for the cancer I'm going to get.
Yeah, I can pay for enough for a loaf of bread and a pound of pasta, you know. And granted, Bob, there was a time in my life when between me and my, between me and my second wife, we hit around 80 in income, gross income. And yet I didn't go out and buy, her boss tried to sell me a used Cadillac, and I just, part of me is a blues musician says, yeah, Cadillac, hell yeah. It fits the image, doesn't it?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's almost job. That's, you could write that off as, you know, official bluesman job equipment.
Yes. But on the other hand, I said, man, do I want to work on that son of a... let me go down south here and buy, get a good used, rust-free car that I can work on. I couldn't get past the cheapskate in me, Bob. You know, the...
Yeah, but see, that's not cheapskate, Bill. That's a willingness to take ownership of your own life.
Yeah, but see, I was raised by... that Second World, not even the Second World War generation, because I only had two cousins that were old enough to get into it, and they went through Germany when a broom was more necessary than an M1. You know, it was pretty much, you know, the German armies in the West, some of them fought bitterly, but a lot of them couldn't take it anymore. They had given everything, believe me, anybody who knows anything about the military would tell you the damn Wehrmacht was a very, if you want to use the word fine, but they could do their jobs very well and very bravely. And but still in all, what the hell were they fighting for? You know, what the hell?
Well, you know, we can kind of ask that question about a number of different military machines.
Yeah.
But that's the last thing that the people at the top ever want the guys walk slogging down the roads with, you know, with packs on their backs and cartridges on their belts. That's the last question they ever want them asking. That's why all the questions get beat out, pretty much worn out of them, beat out of them, whatever, in basic training.
Well,
it's it's the essence of who was it? Alfred Lord Tennyson that wrote the Charge of the Light Brigade. Mine is not to. Ours was not to question why. Ours was but to do and die.
You do and die. Yeah, that's the whole thing, and it's been used again as part of this money grubbing situation. I mean, what in the hell were the industrialists and et cetera in Germany thinking of when some guy who had been a corporal?
What were they thinking of, Bill? They were thinking of what industrialists everywhere think of when war comes around. They were thinking about the same thing that the people at Rockwell or General Dynamics or any other big war. They were thinking they were going to make a bunch of money. Because it's good money when people die in wars.
Yeah, the bottom line for those folks is, again, it comes back to gold.
Sure. I mean, you know, Smedley Butler wrote the seminal treatise, War is a Racket.
I love that.
If he had been writing it from the perspective of a member of the 1%, he would have written, War is a Very Profitable Racket.
Yeah. That guy...
And he does acknowledge that inside the text.
That guy did more with a typewriter than he did with a rifle. Or, you know, I mean, his military record was great, but it was what he said. And that's, I used to have that in my computer. It's not a long text, you know. Oh, was it 6 chapters? Something like that?
Yeah, it's very small, but it takes very little space to lay out the essence of the problem.
Yeah. He laid it all out there, but I'm not going to tie it up anymore. Let's get to one other area. We've been talking about this thing in professional football with the injuries.
Sure.
I'd like to recommend a work by a guy who played for the Browns when I was a kid. It was called, they call it a game. And it was written by a guy named Bernie Parrish, who was a defensive back for the Browns during the end of the Paul Brown era and the beginning of the next one, I believe. Because that book describes how he they would somebody was injured, they'd shoot him full of cortisone and send him back on the field.
Oh yeah. Well, consider the Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers, right? He's out with a busted collarbone.
Yeah.
But he's out with a busted collarbone on his non-throwing side of his body.
Oh, he'll be back out there quickly.
So he's not out for the season. He's not going to just lay back and let that thing heal. No, they're thinking he can be back in 3 or 4 weeks.
Man.
Because it's not on his throwing side. So therefore, you know, let's just not let him get hit on his non-throwing. Let's just not re-injure the... Sure, we can make that happen. Peyton Manning is running around having a career year.
One wrong lick,
he's Captain Pike from Star Trek.
Yeah.
Beep once for yes and two for no.
Yeah, I got into pro football so early. In fact, there was a thing that we hit the newsstands called, I think it was a hipster's lexicon or a hip dictionary, and professional football was called elephant ball. And this came, I remember it must have been the late 50s when I picked up a copy of it, because it was humor. Rather sick humor, but twisted humor, but humor. And it's a shame because I can't, you know, Bob, I got involved with hockey when we had a minor league team here when there was only six in the big leagues. I saw guys that names might have been on the Calder Cups, I mean on the Stanley Cup somewhere. But they, you know, their career got shortened by age and such, and they ended up playing in the American Hockey League, which was teams like Cleveland and that was a team before the Pittsburgh professional, you know, National League team. There was a team, Pittsburgh Hockey. Boy, that was you talk about a rivalry. You know, the Steelers and Browns are a rivalry, but the Pittsburgh Hornets. Was the minor league.
Oh, I'd never even heard of them.
Yeah, a minor league team. And they quit the racket when they built a new rink. And then when they came back, they were part of the first wave of expansions in the National Hockey League. And I listen, I can pick up a station out of Windsor, CKLW, which used to be a great purveyor of rhythm and blues in the 60s, man. I'm telling you. Motown, R&B, and... Man, that's the first two times I ever, or a certain number of times that I ever heard Lonnie Mack's instrumental of Memphis, which was a great piece of guitar work. Have you ever heard that?
No.
Oh, I'll pick it up and let the son hear it. Why am I having trouble with his name?
Berg.
Yeah, Berg. Because a buddy of mine came out last week who taught high school. He taught La Tourette's kids history and in one of the Eastern... Lake County Schools, and I got to hear his son play, and his son plays very, very well, but he's going nowhere in a hurry because the business today is 100% different than in my era. There were bands in every neighborhood and every basement. There were three or four or five guys rehearsing, or a couple of women. And I was thinking of the other night when you were playing the West Coast. What's her name? Jefferson Airplane. What was her name?
Grace Slick.
Oh, man. She wasn't just her singing either, I'll tell you. That was a good-looking kid when she was there. And that was, of course, I had the pleasure of hearing Big Brother with Janice. And a woman I know is touring the country with a performance called Love Janice, which is based on the letters that she wrote. She's a Cleveland girl, a fine singer, a nice kid. And her mother went to nursing school, and the first time I met her mother, she said, you know how many times I listened to you? I thought, oh, God, how old am I? You know. But, yeah, I would recommend that people take a look at this Parrish thing, Bernie Parrish's book, because it just, things have not gotten any better. I mean, these guys are so big today.
Well, look at the guy who bailed out last week. He said, I'm 320 pounds. I need to drop some weight. I want to do some broadcasting. I want to spend time watching my daughter grow up. I want to hang out with my dad. But the linchpin to that is the only place where 6'4" tall, 320-pound people are useful is in football. And even then, or professional wrestling maybe. So even then, it's not healthy.
Even pro wrestling, I mean, and Bob, I used to get tickets and go down to a TV station here in Cleveland, and Saturday afternoon, this is where they build up the crowds for the week at the arena by dramatizing. The announcer would be sitting there, and this one guy, his fans bought him a watch for his birthday. And here come a couple of villains out of the dressing room. They grab their watch, they throw it on the ground, and they're jumping up and down on it. Or his fans baked him a cake, and these same different bunch of villains come out and take the cake and throw it all over the place. I mean, a hustle is a hustle, you know? And I saw it for what it was, but there's a certain time of your life when you're 12, 13, 14, this stuff reaches out and grabs you.
Because yeah, it speaks to you.
And with me and my friends, it was not the action, the slapstick humor. I mean, let's face it, a guy fans bake him a cake and somebody comes out and throws it at him or destroys it. I mean, Bob, I'm still one of these guys that you show me a guy catching a good pie in the face, and I would laugh.
Oh, no. I'm always on board for a good pratfall.
Well, Mo Howard got a load of pie one time that he clogged his throat momentarily.
The pie in the face, the pratfall, physical comedy a la W.C. Fields.
Yeah.
There's that one little brilliant scene in The Bank Dick where, he gets the liquor bottle delivered to the bar. The sidecar glass of water is set down next to him. There's a napkin. He takes the cap off the bottle and says, remove your hat in the presence of a gentleman. Pours himself a shot of liquor, downs the shot out of the shot glass, rinses his finger in the sidecar glass, dries his fingers off on the napkin, tosses it over his shoulder, and kicks it with the back of his heel into a garbage can. Because his first career was as an acrobat. Hard to imagine, but it's true.
Did you ever see...
That put me on the floor.
Were you a Stooge fan?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they did about three versions of the same thing with their plumbers.
Mm-hmm.
And the water is, you know, you turn on, and there's some villains trying to steal. At one point, there's a cook in the kitchen. And this man does, I counted him one time, seven of the nicest, funniest pratfalls I ever saw in my life. Again, there's an art form to almost everything when it comes to performance.
Well, up until he broke his leg doing one, Chevy, live on TV, no less.
Oh, yeah.
Chase was brilliant with him. Well, hey, Bill, we've got a couple of blinking lights.
And there's some good people coming on. And
it's good to talk to you again after being gone a few days, man.
Things are working out on the apartment end of things, so, you know, I'll be off the air for a while. That'll make people happy. When I have to move, you got to wait for the computer to go up, and I've got friends in the family who have helped me so much with that. I've got to mention these folks, and I speak with them quite regularly, and they're great guys, Bob. Great folks. You take care.
Thanks, Bill. You take care, too. Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, and we'll keep the lines going here. Just a quick note, I conjured horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner, and he says, yes, I'm sure that the Koch brothers, these energy CEOs, these billionaires would qualify as sociopaths. A member of the Koch family ran a concentration camp in Germany in World War II and did the research on human soap. Really? Wowzer. So, continuing along. Hey, welcome to the program.
What's up, Bob?
Hey, what's happening, Jim?
Oh,
nuts. I didn't do that. I touched nothing. So, Jim, ring back in, and we'll try to get to you as quickly as possible. Marty says, tell Bill he and his stories are looked forward to. I will miss not hearing him for a few days. And hopefully Bill will give us a heads up when those few days come around so we won't worry and fret. Thank you, Randy. I really did. He says, you didn't do fundraising tonight. Yes, I did. And I want to thank Tony for jumping in. We are raising a little bit of money this evening. We've got about 35 folks at $10 a piece to go, and in whatever combination works out. But that'll $38 at $10 a piece would get us out of the hole tonight. So thank you very kindly to Sal and to Tony and to the and to Thomas and to Khalil and to everyone whose subscriptions came in over the course of the time that I was gone. Thank you very much. Hey, welcome to the program.
And how are you this evening?
I'm good, Jim.
Your trip?
It was an excellent trip, for the most part. Flying. It's just a miserable experience. Some is better than others, but it's not so much the airplane, although, you get the occasional Roger Ramjet who wants to dive bomb clouds and stuff, but it's the airport experience, I think.
I've been there, done that, through all the major airports in the world.
Well, you know what? I figured out something. For all the talk about Minnesota nice, the people in the TSA folks in Minneapolis are among the rudest I have ever encountered. I mean, they were just rude for the sake of being rude.
That used to be a very nice airport. I used to enjoy the one going through. What's the one that has all the shopping malls in it? It's I can't even remember.
Well, I mean, there's a sort of mall in Minneapolis. They got a lot of shopping areas. Atlanta. But you know what always strikes me is who's blowing through the airport or has a couple hours layover and thinks, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go into Brooks Brothers and buy a $1,000 sport coat. That's what I'm going to do.
Well, it depends on what your layover is. Maybe you have a little time. But nonetheless, I always enjoy going through those malls and stuff like that. Of course, some people don't like to shop, but that's basically, why I did pick up some neat things in there. Just a question here. The Koch brothers is related to the Commandant of Buchenwald. Ilse Koch?
Apparently, if what I understand from
I don't believe that.
They had to leave Germany sometime or another.
Well, one left to never appear again, and the other one, I'm not sure what they did with his wife, because she was the one who made...
No, I'm talking about maybe they had a common grandfather or a common great-grandfather, something like that.
Well, I don't know about that. Now, I'll just put a big question mark on that. But the other one, the wife was the one who made the lampshades and things like that from people who had,
Jesus,
the tattoos and stuff like that. Ilse Koch. So, I mean, I don't want to pin that on anybody unless there's an accurate definition of kinship.
No, you know what? It is plenty to pin on the Koch brothers themselves. The fact that they are willing to poison tens of thousands, if not millions, of human beings to make more money.
Well, as far as the sociopathy of that's concerned, there's some people who are just damn right greedy. That's all there is to it. It's just innate greed. I mean, they may have some type of ability to have some type of relationship with their family or a close, a wife or husband or something like that, but I don't know. I have yet to see any sociological study on some of these people.
Well, actually, they're out there. There's a British researcher who has done a considerable amount of research who says that sociopaths in the upper levels of corporate structures the world over exist in much higher concentrations than they do in the general population. Because corporate structures value the kind of personalities that a sociopath brings to the table.
Well, they're the kind of person they want. Because
no conscience?
Well, they have no compassion. They have no feeling. And, if you have outlived your usefulness as far as one of their employees are concerned, or if you can be replaced by something that's bigger and better and cheaper, they're going to remove you and... really have no feeling or compassion at all. So I mean, you know, it's a strange thing. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I've seen photographs or movies of the SS shooting people in ditches, while at the same point they're petting the German shepherds and just crooning to them.
Oh, I remember seeing those famous photographs of Christmas at Auschwitz.
I mean, you know, basically these people had some type of affectional link to certain things, but none to others. That's what I'm saying.
And that is psychologically pathological.
Well, I don't know if it's pathological or not.
It renders evidence about psychological.
Well, you know, Adolf Hitler once said, "Now that I know men, I prefer dogs." So there it is. Maybe they took his example. The reason I called initially before you got involved with Mr. Stress was about Yellowstone and what's going on with it. Apparently, there's quite a large magma chamber underneath that particular caldera.
Yeah, it's hundreds of miles across or something.
And it is building up. As you said, not by a year, but, you know, by year. And eventually it's going to, probably start building up by inches per month and per week.
The article I was looking at, the scientist in question said he had never seen what is going on now there.
Well, if that...
The level of activity.
Well, if that particular one were to go, the continental United States, or what I call CONUS, would cease to exist. I mean...
Yeah, I had a note from Jeremy a little while back noting that it has been described as an ELE, an extinction-level event.
Right. And even if you were able to withstand the occlusion that would be presented in the atmosphere by all the stuff that would come out of that particular volcano, you would have literally the Great Lakes flowing into the Gulf of Mexico. And God only knows what that would trigger as far as California and the Southwest is concerned, you know?
Right. Consider synergistic responses, Jim. We're in a cycle where it's not just one thing, it's several things, and you add in something like that.
But, you know, these are things that happen in certain cases of their own accord because of the Earth being what it is and bound together by so many tectonic plates. I mean, initially, you had a huge continent called Pangaea. Now, what happened to it? That particular continent separated because the Earth is the Earth, and that's the way the mantle and the crust of the Earth are, and it's just going to do it. You know, basically, it's just going to do it. I mean, it's happened throughout recorded history and non-recorded history. Geologists have found that, you know, basically, these tectonic plates basically rub against each other. And when they get to the point where they can't rub anymore, all that friction's built up, and you have with friction energy, a coefficient thereof, they're going to split wide open. And there's nothing you can do about it or nothing you can do to prevent it. That's just the way it is.
What if, Jim, people are being allowed to do something that facilitates it?
Well, I don't know exactly what geologists say about activities like fracking and things like that. I don't think it's certainly a good thing for it. But what I'm saying is, I do believe sincerely that these seismic events basically are going, you know, they are going to occur on a periodic basis.
I saw another horrifying story just a few days ago that while they were trying to extract the incredibly dangerous, deadly spent fuel rods at Fukushima, an earthquake struck. That's what I meant about synergistic reactions.
Well, the two have nothing to do with what...
No, they don't, except for the fact that while you're dealing with one and the other thing happens, then the potential catastrophic event ramps up exponentially.
Well, you know, we've had problems with nuclear power plants ever since they came into being. I mean, it takes how many years to build one? One or two, three or four, depending on the type of quality of workmanship that goes into it.
Right.
And the other things. And it takes over 25 years to decommission one, basically, to bring it into where it's not any, you know, it's not harmful anymore. But nonetheless, I mean, these things are very effective in producing energy, and they're very effective in producing heat, this, that, the other, until, guess what? The earth opens up underneath it, or a technician scrams the reactor the way he did in Chernobyl. I mean, that's exactly what, you know, they are. I mean, and we've got them all over this country, all over the world. And I think there is a proliferation of nuclear power plants. So it really just doesn't appear to be, optimist that I am, quote.
He said, tongue firmly in cheek.
Any really safe way to produce the amount of energy that 9 billion people on this planet require. Because even with solar, wind, or whatever, even geothermal, and even geothermal has its drawbacks because you never can tell what's going to come up through that, to produce the amount of energy that people are using. It's just no way. No way whatsoever. I mean, as far as bringing it up to the...
And yet we know at the same time that coal, oil, and gas are nothing if not catastrophic for the human species.
Well, you know, every time you get in your car and turn on the key, there you go. You're dependent on it. You have to have it. You have to have petroleum to ride, or gasoline to drive your car or to fly your airplane. I mean, you know, you did just this very weekend. And, of course, you know, that was X number of, I mean, that's just the way the world is. That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, until they can, maybe they can develop some type of propulsion system and heating system that is benevolent, and none of them really are, that would bring you up to the level of efficiency of the required usage as is today. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right. Well, I think part of that has to do with the fact that the world is incapable of the kind of concerted effort that it needs to make in order to forestall, if we for a moment put aside the potentialities of natural disasters, the world lacks the will and the cohesiveness to do that which is necessary to forestall man-made disasters.
I understand that. Didn't they just have a meeting in Poland about that?
Mm-hmm.
And what did they come away with? Nothing.
I don't know what the Polish word is for nothing, but I think it's nothing.
Well, it's just nothing, and, you know, it would appear as though...
Isn't the Russian niete or something like that?
Yeah, niet, no. And basically, that's just the way it is. I mean, you know, there are all types of well-intentioned, goodwill people out there who would prefer to have a cleaner world, a better world. But there's so many more who will, at any cost, at any price, at any expense, maintain an energy consumption. And when you have all these people, 9 billion of them, rubbing shoulders together, needing this, that, and the other.
Well, that's like what I said about what I learned about China on my trip. China is a nation in an unacknowledged death spiral.
Well, they're trying to have some reforms over there, so I hear.
But I just saw a story today that they are relaxing the one-child policy.
Well, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's absolutely nuts, because, I mean, you know, people in Beijing, I mean, I don't even think Beijing ever has a clear sky anymore because of all the stuff, because of the, you know, the way the Chinese are exploiting. But they have a history of doing that, particularly in the last 50 years. I mean, you know, I remember the Great Leap Forward.
Well, there's a long history in what we call China of cultural expansion and contraction. You know, the what were they called? The treasure fleets? Was that the 14th century?
Well, there was one emperor who was very much, or a series of emperors who were very much interested in building huge ships. And then,
yeah, that was the treasure fleets. And by the time they came back from their last journey,
they were outmoded.
Well, the dynasty had changed, and suddenly no ships were allowed to leave, and China contracted in on itself.
Yeah, it did. I mean, they were being absolutely pummeled, I guess, from outer forces, and the reason to build the wall, and they wanted to insulate itself. I mean, they had huge ships.
If I'm not mistaken, this is post-wall, because the origins of the treasure fleets were in the 14th century under the dynasty established by Kublai Khan. And it was after the overthrow of that dynasty that China retracted into itself again.
Well, I will say this. Kublai Khan was definitely an expansionist, that's for sure. And he expanded as far as he possibly could. And then, of course, I guess China, as a reaction to all the overruns by the Mongols and Tatars and so many people. I mean, there's so many, you know, there were so many invasions and so many internecine quarrels within the succeeding dynasty itself that, yeah, China would collapse into itself. And it took, what, the British to open it back up again. And, of course, you had so many wars and things like that. But nonetheless, it is strange to me that they would relax the one-child policy. And precisely, did you hear any more about the regulations for that, as far as can they have two?
No, I just caught the sort of synopsis of the story and moved on.
Well, I can remember. I don't know if this is true or not. If the baby were a boy, it's fine. If it were a girl, they was left to die. They didn't particularly want it. I've heard that story too about their method of selection of population. Not a very nice thing, but nonetheless, that's what I have read then.
Yeah, this is. I just looked it up, Jim. It is via Agence France-Presse. State media announced that China will relax its hugely controversial one-child policy. A shift announced days after a meeting of China's top Communist Party leaders.
Yeah,
couples will be allowed to have two children if one of the parents is an only child.
Okay. I knew there were regulations on that. I knew they would not open it completely up. But
isn't even that kind of counterintuitive? Because after a generation of the one-child policy, everybody's going to be an only child, and therefore everybody will get to have two kids.
Well, that's what the Politburo has decided, so I guess they, in their wisdom, always known to make the best decisions, have decided to change that particular...
In this article, one expert China watcher, a Chinese population expert, said, "I would not be surprised if a year from now we're going to see more and more and even a complete abandonment of the policy." Consider this in light, I don't know, did you see this, Jim, the kerfuffle over the stupid little skit on Jimmy Kimmel's TV program?
I missed that one.
You're probably good. It's probably a good thing, because you might have used some, I don't know, Anglo-Saxonisms. But, okay, so the gist of this is that Jimmy Kimmel has had some skit called the Children's Table or something like that.
Right.
And in it, they ask apparently adult questions of children. And, there's a history of this. Think of Art Linkletter and Kids Say the Darndest Things.
Art Linkletter. Now, he was a piece of work, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. So the question gets put, it's some sort of question about China and population and the world being overpopulated. And one little girl looks up and says, well, we could just kill all the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm sure that went over like a lead balloon.
In Beijing. Because it got all the way to Beijing in a drop-dead hurry, Jim.
Oh, in real time, you know they did, because they're watching all that stuff.
And so consequently, and they take things in translation the way we take things in translation. You remember when Ronald Reagan was just funning around before the weekly radio address and didn't know the mic was hot and said...
We start bombing Russia in 5 minutes.
And Moscow took that very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And nearly caused did cause an international incident.
It did cause some problems, that's for sure. It made the papers.
So the Chinese Politburo operates in ways that are largely foreign and mysterious to the West.
Well, they always have, but you know their entire government system has always been designed to be extremely closed and
opaque
and non-transparent.
And so to that end, the Chinese government lodged a formal complaint. Demanded that ABC retract Jimmy Kimmel's call for the genocide of the Chinese, which is how they understood it and how they perceived and received it. And lo and behold, a few days after, and I hadn't, this story happened a week or so ago, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then, lo and behold, 3 days ago, this story pops up that the Politburo has met and decided to relax the one-child policy.
Well, I don't know if that had anything to do with...
I don't either, but then again, the workings of the Chinese government is nothing if not opaque.
Well, I mean, these guys just don't get together and just plan this stuff in one day. I mean, they have to, they have to lay plans in the out years and things of that nature. So I don't think what Jimmy Kimmel said had anything to do with it. I do think that he owes Beijing a formal apology, and he needs to never reference that again.
Oh, ABC has already done it for him. The skit of which it was part has been forever forbidden, and the Chinese and ABC and Disney, who owns ABC, have been groveling for all they're worth, not because they recognize that a child contemplating the potential of genocide is wrong, but because they are deeply disturbed by the fact that they may not get their movies into the Chinese market, which is very lucrative.
Of course. I mean, you know, that's always the driving force behind corporations and their policies, and when people who work for them make mistakes, or they have people on their programs who do make mistakes, they're going to have to, you know, retract or whatever. It's not for basically for the respect of the human being, it's for their own, you know, corporate interest. There you go. And so that doesn't surprise me at all, you know, absolutely what you said there. But it's a very strange situation in which China, with its burgeoning population, would have that type of policy unless they have anticipated some type of expansion. And what I'm trying to say here, and I want to lead into this, and I won't be on here too long, the original borders between China and the Russian continent were determined by the Treaty of Dzerzhinsk of 1689. Okay?
Okay.
Under Mao, that treaty was totally disregarded, and Chinese students were taught that China expanded way far in to what was in the eastern part of the Soviet Union. And that's been a standing fact ever since Harrison Salisbury's book, War Between Russia and China, came out in 1969. So you've got one treaty that, you know, basically to the Chinese people means this is all our land up there too. And then you've got people in Moscow saying, No, it's not. And so when you get together thinking about those two rubbing shoulders, it'll cause you friction. Well, that's not a good thing. But, I mean, you know, it's called expansion. Whenever you have more people, I mean, the Russians haven't really populated that well their area above China, particularly in Siberia. It's pretty hostile territory. I mean, they have some big cities up there, Irkutsk and places like that. They have spots of mineral deposits and gold mines and tungsten and titanium, particularly, because I think the Soviet Union is particularly wealthy in rare element types of metals, okay?
Yeah.
But you don't have that many people. Because under the old system, they used to have to pay a pay and a half to go out there, and they, you know, they had to use all types of incentives to have these people go out there and work for a certain period of time. But you know, I would think, and this is just projection on my part, and you know, kick me for being wrong, but it would not surprise me as if, in long range terms, you're going to have an expansion of China into part of Siberia. After all, like I say, under
Mao, that could be a very globally stressful situation.
Yeah, under Mao, I mean, they were taught, and you know, that their whole country extended, as I said before, way up into what was formerly controlled by the USSR. And they've never been real good friends. I mean, they had a brief honeymoon with communism. And then, of course, you had in the late 60s constant problems between the Chinese and the Russian soldiers on the Amur River. And it got to the point that Harrison Salisbury wrote this book, War Between Russia and China. I wish you could find it and read it. Because I'll guarantee you one thing, it'll definitely put some lead in your pencil. And now China has basically come out of a certain mode and has begun to expand, and they have more population, and they need more minerals and research and stuff like that to get more. I mean, hell, that's the reason Japan invaded Manchuria in the 1930s. You know, it's basically scrambling for all the wealth and material and things like that.
Right.
And in an industrialized society. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, I'll put that on the back burner, but it wouldn't surprise me if there would be some problems between the redrawing of a map or wishful thinking on the part of Beijing.
Well, great, great problems on this planet have been caused by crisis-driven human migration.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, basically it's driven by people that if the land can't support them, then they're going to have to go somewhere else where the land will, or the same thing with corporations or businesses. But nonetheless, that's just something in the future. But I was just, like I say, I'm constantly, you know, worried about this thing in Yellowstone, because apparently our geologists are saying not if, but when. Because it's due. I think it's every like 600,000 years or something like that. But it has happened before. And that would really create a bit of a sticky wicket for everyone.
Absolutely. And it's worth considering, you know, the theory that's posited that a massive asteroid strike helped to wipe out the dinosaurs. And we know where the crater is now. It's basically around the Yucatan Peninsula and out into the Gulf of Mexico. I learned something. One of the great things about when I go on trips like this is I get to learn stuff I didn't know. It's a huge iron mining region throughout that upper Midwest, the Northland, northern Minnesota, Hibbing, around in there. Huge iron deposits.
Oh, yeah.
And I happened to learn where the iron deposits came from. They're not a function of the development of the earth like, say, coal is. Those iron deposits are present because there is, and it's verifiable, there's a massive blast crater that's been covered in over the millions and millions and millions of years But that's a giant asteroid strike.
Exactly. And you have also very wealthy deposits of iridium. And that's something that isn't found on the Earth. That has to come from a meteorite hitting the Earth. That's how they can measure exactly how big these things were and what impact they had, is the levels of iridium, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, you know, we're swimming through space, and basically scientists 20 years ago, I think before the Hubble telescope and before the development of technology and the awareness of our vulnerability as we swim through space, of just how quickly Earth could become a target. I mean, just recently, one just came within, 250,000 miles of the Earth?
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically the same distance of the moon from the Earth. I mean, that's, wow.
We're flying around in a giant pinball machine.
Yeah, it looks,
or maybe nice. Maybe the better analogy is a pachinko machine.
Whatever. But, you know, it's something to consider. It's something not to worry about when you're trying to sleep. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, if it happens, it happens. And that's all there is to it. Nothing they can do about it, I don't think. I mean, you've seen all these science fiction movies in which they go up there and they destroy the so-called asteroid with nuclear weapons and this, that, and the other. And then when they do that, all they do is blow it into bigger pieces, which covers a lot more area. But, you know, it just seems like Hollywood's really taking advantage of that. But, you know, I think there are a lot of people that are much more aware, because not of Hollywood, but because of scientific research and the ability of our stargazers, for lack of a better term, our scientists, to see exactly what is out there. And it's just amazing it hasn't happened before, you know, more recently than it, you know, than it did. I mean, I think the most recent big one was what, in Siberia, Tunguska?
Yeah, in recent memory.
Yeah, and that thing lit up the whole sky, and I mean, they could see the sky being lit up from that in London. And of course, when the Russian scientists went out there, well, they had limited access to it. I guess they were underneath the Tsar at that time when the revolution happened. They sort of forgot it. And then Soviet scientists and physicists went out there and saw exactly what had happened, and, you know, whether it impacted or exploded right above the Earth. You never can tell. But it's interesting to see what will happen on our blue planet, and it's a pretty frustrating time in which to live, is what I'm trying to say. You know, it is. To have some type of peace of mind that used to be obtainable, say, 30, 40 years ago. You know, I don't remember growing up fearing an asteroid or a meteorite destroying the Earth. Do you?
No, or for that matter, fearing
Yellowstone.
Or fearing a 6'6" tall, disaffected Saudi with a portable dialysis machine, either for that matter.
Well, yeah, these people come and go, but nonetheless, I don't even know if he really had a dialysis machine. I don't think he did. I don't think he did. I think they would have found that when they went in there and killed him. I don't know where that came from. I mean, there's a lot of mystery.
I don't either. It just creates an interesting image of...
Well, that's something probably that came out of the CIA or something like that. They want.
One of our propaganda mills.
Well, yeah, exactly. But nonetheless, you know, life has really changed a lot over the past 50 years, that's for sure. And, you know, we're coming up, and I'm going to end this conversation, on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. And I hope that we can remember him and his wonderful wife, who did an awful lot for this country, and remember how they were taken from us too soon. But then again, they played a very dutiful role in the history of the world, particularly President Kennedy with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because we came, I don't know how close to losing everything. I mean, it was just a hair's breadth and it was through his judgment.
Absolutely, and that's one of those places where you consider the little historical forks in the road. Contemplate this, Jim. Contemplate the Cuban Missile Crisis in the hands of President Richard M. Nixon.
Well, he may have been a little more, he may have done better than you might think, because Nixon's strong point was foreign policy. And he could probably have, or he could probably, I think, would have solved it one way or the other. I really do. Because he...
Or put it 2 years into the future, or 3 years into the future, with, say, President Goldwater.
Well, that's a different situation there.
Yes, it is.
I mean, you know, you got people who, well...
Well, no, I mean, consider the Cold War with President Goldwater.
Well, we never had AUH2O in there, but we did have some ones who did come kind of close, and, you know, President Reagan gave me some very, very chilling moments.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember, basically, you know, NATO has its periodic exercises. There was one called Reforger, in which we would send troops into Germany and simulate an attack upon the Soviet Union and vice versa. And there was one incident back in, I think it was 83, in which we damn well went to war, because the Soviets had anticipated that this was not an exercise. This was something that was real, and it was just minutes, 5 minutes away from launch on warning. Have you ever heard that story?
No.
Well, it happened. And I was in the place of the when and where it happened, okay? We damn near went to war over just a mistake.
Wow. So, I hope we'll have time some evening and give it the depth that it deserves.
Well, I don't know if I really can tell you the truth, but you look up Reforger, R-E-F-O-R-G-E-R. It was an annual exercise in which our troops with NATO would coalesce, and they would do military exercises. And this is back when, of course, they thought the Soviet hordes would pour through the full of the gap. And because of some electronic thing or some type of thing and computer, that it almost went to the same thing that happened in 1962. And this was, I think, 83 84. It was back during the heyday of the Reagan Cold War, when, you know, he was like tweaking their noses and calling them evil empire and stuff like that, and they were just, you know, they were just ready to go. But look up Reforger and what it means, as far as you'll find out all the information you need to know. But I've taken up too much of your time. I'm glad you've had a safe trip back and learned a lot up there in Wisconsin. And let's say that it will serve you in good stead.
I think so. And good people. And you know, I get inspired and recharged up there. Jim, have yourself a good evening.
The same to you, sir.
All right. Take care.
Good night.
Bye now. Our buddy Jim, not too awfully far away from here at all. Let's roll on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jim. Sorry I lost you a couple of minutes ago.
It might have been my phone, although usually it doesn't drop, but once in a while it does. Sorry about that. I don't know. But,
no worries.
Yeah, I've been catching your show most of the podcast and stuff, because I've got this job which requires me to work at night sometimes, at least. But it's, you know, the typical part-time job.
Right.
It's kind of hard, especially where I'm located now. It's real hard to get full-time employment.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
As you know, it's coming up on the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination.
And I imagine, I was thinking earlier, I imagine that's been it's been within the realm of your consideration.
Well, yeah. I mean, I did see Bill Maher the other night in New Orleans. This is great. My brother and my sister-in-law brought him. It was pretty good. But, I mean, as far as, like, the JFK assassination, a good book, which I think I might have mentioned it once before, written by Fletcher Prouty, JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the plot to assassinate John F. Kennedy, which I haven't really read it, but Prouty worked on the movie JFK, which I think is pretty solid. But I mean, just look at in it, just in a foreword by written by Jesse Ventura. He touches on things like you've heard of Operation Northwoods, right?
Sure.
And basically, that's includes attacks on American cities, ships, and people to create a pretext to launch an attack on Cuba. Sounds a lot like Iraq.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe just repackaged and recycled with a different soundtrack.
Yeah. I mean, and you try and explain that to people, and people just... I really don't even try to, you know, I let people believe what they want. You know, it's almost like religion. You know, and then there's, what is it, the NSA in Order 273 after JFK was executed, which reversed, because JFK, what I understand, was planned to pull out after 65, after the 64 election. You know, so that's, you know, to me, it's not obvious, but you know, I'm kind of biased, but, it's weird because I'll catch things on TV sometimes. A little bit I watched, like I saw something a couple of days ago on Morning Joe. Imagine that, something.
Big dose of Pepto Bismol and turn the TV on. Yeah, I know.
So, it was some guy coming up with. To me, it just irritates the hell out of me when I hear somebody say, well, yeah, Oswald did it and it was the lone gunman, and it's just. You know what I mean? And I'm no weapons expert, but a bolt-action rifle, and that rifle that he had was basically called, I think...
It was a man-licker.
Yeah, but they called it the survivor's rifle or something like that, it was not... very accurate gun. Yeah, and so, like, the Widowmaker was the, it somehow allowed the individual to escape without getting shot. But I'm curious to see, isn't there supposed to be some big thing in Dallas or a couple of...
Well, yeah, they're going to have a big thing in Dallas, but they're never going to say the word assassination.
But he got hit by a car or something?
I mean, I hate to laugh, but that's tonight's toaster, Jim.
Thank you.
Got hit by a car?
Yeah, it was with traffic. He was going down...
He was just walking across Dealey Plaza and whack!
Got hit by a car. That could be the... Well, I mean, they tell all sorts of things. You know, it's just like 9/11. And I'm... I remember when I got up that morning seeing not less than a plane threat because I was living in Vegas. And, so I was going to work and it was like 6 o'clock in the morning. And it was like a couple minutes after six. And it already had happened. And they had it, I had it on the TV. And yeah, it was. You know what? I'm like, this is really. And then, like, the second one hits, and I'm like, it's real fishy. And, I haven't really looked into it, but I definitely believe, you know, I go with those people. What's that group? The walkie texts for the truth about 9/11 or whatever. I tend to go with them. I mean, and the way I look at it, people say, well, some people might say, well, you know, that they killed 3,000 people. The people, the 1%, the people who really pull the strings and run this country, don't give a rat's ass about killing 3,000 people. You know?
Right. What is ten people dying is a tragedy, 10,000 is a statistic?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they let 58,000 die for basically no reason in Vietnam. I mean, and even connection with a secret peace plan still in the war on for 4 more years. They got tired. They just figured, well, obviously not going to win. And I don't think they... It was just, it's like the old fish here, spent plenty of good money to find the army with the tools of the trade. And in kind of changing subjects a little bit, like what some of your previous callers had touched on, I don't even think, but I think what we're doing to the planet environmentally, I don't think there's that much. They say 100 years, but I you know, the times as the water rises, you notice that with the hurricane, they call it tsunami.
Yeah, and consider, Jim, that and I heard it for myself with my own ears just last night. Some woman from Politico was talking to the right winger Jim Bohannon, who has Larry King's old radio slot from 10 to 1, 9 to midnight, something like that. And I was driving home from the airport, and I heard her compare the troubles with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act website to Katrina. And I just about had to pull the car over on the side of the road and just get outside and kick something and swear for a while. Because these right-wing pigs have no shame.
Yeah.
No comparison between Katrina and a buggy website. There were 1,800 people dying in attics and floating face down in the fetid waters of failed levees, while George Guitar Bush played a guitar upside down in Arizona, and a website with some problems. There's no comparison, but that tells us the level of concern that the right wing has for the people who suffer in these kinds of disasters.
Yeah. I mean,
I wonder if any... And this woman was like some sort of political something or another, used to be with USA Today, now she's with Politico, and yada, 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 yada. And I wonder if anybody there at the evening martini slurp looked at her and said, "Sister, that's just a little bit effed up. Check your privilege." I don't think so either. They just said another round for the genius.
To get to that position, you got to play. It's like you would never get to that position. No way, no how.
And by the way, you just got a little confirmation in from our buddy Mark with regard to that Mannlicher rifle. He says, I fired expert in the Marine Corps with pistol and rifle over 10 years. And with that rifle, you cannot hit a moving target.
Yeah. Like I say, it's known as the... it's got a real sarcastic nickname. They mentioned in the book I mentioned. Instead of the widow maker, the survivor maker, or something to that effect.
My favorite take on it is from the prophet Bill Hicks, peace be upon him.
Peace be upon Bill.
Who said, upon going to visit the museum that is now there at the Dallas Book Depository, He said they've got a. He said at the time, he said they've got a barrier there around the window in question. And he said the reason it's there is because if you get to actually stand there and look out the window, the first things that comes out, the first words that come out of your mouth are, "No effing way."
Yeah. Well, I went to. I was coming back from Seattle when I lived in Seattle. I was coming back and I went through Dallas and I was with my brother and we went to Dealey Plaza. And it's amazing. I might have said this to you a couple months ago. It's amazing how small it is. It's not big. I mean, the whole area. I mean, and then you think about it. You know, I even went to the grassy knoll. It's almost the perfect place for an assassination. It's a, you know.
Yeah, almost like he was funneled into it.
Well, I mean. Yeah, and from what I understand, I mean, my health, my head is full of facts or things I've learned. I heard the parade route was changed like the day before.
Yeah, I saw one of the, you know, just the other day, I saw one of those flyers, Jim, that some Republican had put out with a picture of JFK on it saying, you know, don't you come down here to Texas.
Yep. Yeah, it's, but I mean, then just kind of changing the subject, I mean, it's like the way the American people, a certain segment, in Obama, he's not, my favorite, as I've said, but he should have won by 78%. The people who vote Republican, who have no clue what the Republicans really, if they had their way, would do to them. I mean, I know 70-year-old people who are staunch Republicans, and it's like, do you realize, you stupid coot, that they would get rid of it? If they had their way, you wouldn't have Social Security.
Yeah, you know, Elizabeth Warren said something recently. She started calling for an expansion of Social Security. She wants the benefits increased. And she's getting close to where we really need to be. You know, these asses are out there saying, oh, it's going to go broke. It's killing us all, Social Security. And in point of fact, the real answer is, yeah, let's pay more benefits to people drawing Social Security, and let's lower the retirement age so that young people can get into the system, into jobs, and start paying into it. Add that to some sort of immigration reform where people can work legally and out in the bright light of day. Guess what? No more Social Security problem. So when you think of, when you hear some Republican talking about, oh, we need border security, what he's saying is we're scared to death that if we start letting people work legally, A, they'll want more money from, you know, our buddies, and B, we won't be able to bitch about Social Security anymore.
Yeah. Well, from what I understand, Social Security's got a good 30, 40 years before there's really even any problem. And if you really want to just... from my simple mind, you want to solve it, take off the cap.
Take off the cap, lower the retirement age, modernize benefits, and let people work in the full light, full legal light of day. In other words, immigration reform, no Social Security problem.
And let that nitwit Mitt Romney pay Social Security on all that money.
On every damned penny.
Exactly.
And then find a way to make Paul Ryan the mayor of some very small uninhabited island that's about 2 inches from sinking beneath the ocean.
And one more thing you pointed out a couple of weeks ago, or I heard about, tax the goddamn churches. I'm an atheist. I don't feel like giving them a tax break. I don't get a tax break for necessarily being an atheist. So, F the churches, tax them. You know?
I'm there. By the way, your compadre, Jim, just sent an email. He said, famous last words, Jackie, we're entering nut country today.
Who said that? Did JFK say that?
November 22nd, Fort Worth, Texas. JFK to Jackie. We're entering nut country today. Well, Jim, have yourself a good evening. I'm sorry we lost you on the first time through, but I hope we'll talk soon.
Okay, baby, I'll try. I think I'll be off. I'm pretty sure I'm off Friday, and I'll try, hopefully.
Oh, jump in on the front porch. I'll be looking forward to it.
All right, buddy.
All right, you take care. Bye now. Our buddy Jim calling from somewhere in Louisiana, Stan. And that's it for this Titanic Tuesday. Thanks for all the participation. Good conversations this evening. Share around Jeff Bigger's article, please, from the beginning of the program. Share that around. And I want to thank Paul. Paul just reduced the deficit here at the Horn by down to $365 to raise. So if we could round up 336 folks at 10 bucks apiece between now and, say, tomorrow morning, we'd be in a lot better shape for seeing a December come along for the Horn. Any way, any denomination, any help is welcome, one and all. Thanks very kindly. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Nobody has done more to preserve progressive radio in the United States than Ben Birch at the White Rose Society, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, living in the shadow of a mountaintop removal operation, subjected to those poisons every day. They refuse to surrender, they refuse to go away, and they insist on being a driving force in ending the Appalachian apocalypse that is mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. That's where you go if you want to help us end mountaintop removal. ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. And Rick Smith is next on the Horn.